Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I was watching NBC News the other night, and there were some statistics that were presented that just knocked me out. 70% of Americans are now considered overweight. Isn't that a huge number? And the other statistic that was amazing was in 1960, men weighed on the average 166 pounds. They now weigh on the average 195 pounds. Women average weighed 140 and now 165. So something's going on with our diets, our plate sizes, and we thought we would look at this issue this hour. Professor Marion Nessel is our first guest. She'll be with us the first half hour. Paulette Goddard, professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University, former senior nutrition policy advisor in the Department of Health and Human Services. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I'm sure we'll have many this hour. 800-486-8655 is the number and the email address. You can use that as well. Is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Marion Nessel, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, pleasure to be here.
70% of us are overweight. Isn't that huge?
It's absolutely huge, to coin a term.
Right.
And a lot of it has to do with a very simple fact. We're eating more, and we're moving either the same or less. Big argument about that.
Right. And we're eating more. Why?
Well, I would argue it's because the food environment has changed to one in which food is available at all times, day and night. It's become socially acceptable to eat in more places at more times of day in larger quantities. And actually, you don't need anything more than larger portion sizes to explain the increase in weight. We're just eating more.
And if you eat, do you know the figures on this? How many more calories per day? It can add up to a lot of pounds every year.
Well, it can, and it's very difficult to get accurate information about population dietary intake, but there are more than 700 calories available in the food supply now than there were in 1980 when rates of obesity first started to rise. And people report eating 200 calories more a day than they did in 1980. But that's on an average across the entire population. And in fact, people who are gaining weight are eating hundreds of calories more a day than people used to 25 or 30 years ago.
These figures that I mentioned at the top of the show are also pretty extraordinary, that women used to, on the average in 1960, 140, the average weight, it's now 165. Men, it used to be 166, it's now 195. What are the health implications for that?
Well, being overweight for some people, actually a lot of people, raises the risk for a whole variety of chronic diseases, and type 2 diabetes is the most obvious. We are experiencing a parallel epidemic in type 2 diabetes, even among very young children. It used to be an adult disease. Now it's a disease of very young children as well. And it's not that every it's not that every overweight person is going to develop type 2 diabetes. It's just that the risk is higher. And if you look at people with type 2 diabetes, a very large fraction of them are overweight. And so that would be the one thing. And then mechanical difficulties, just getting around, and the pressure on knee joints and so forth. It's not good to be overweight.
Right. And what about the fact that people are living longer? Is it natural to gain weight as you age? And do any of these statistics have to do with just an older population?
I don't know how you define natural in that situation. Anybody who is headed into middle age will tell you that they cannot eat the way they used to without gaining weight. And I think that's absolutely clear. Your metabolism slows down. And you can't eat as much, but we don't change our eating habits. But I want to go back to portion size, because portion sizes are very deceptive. And there's something hardwired in us to eat whatever food is put in
front
of us.
Right.
And there's now been a terrific amount of research that shows that if you have a large portion of food in front of you, you'll eat more calories from it than you would if there were a smaller portion, even if you don't finish it. And you will underestimate the number of calories that you ate from it by a much larger fraction. So there's something about these very big portions of food that makes people eat more,
mm-hmm.
quite unconsciously. And even if they, if people are conscious of it and know that large portions make them eat more, they still eat more.
And this is very true in restaurants, isn't it?
Oh, yes, because restaurants have discovered that a really great way to sell food is to serve lots of it. People love a bargain. And when restaurants try to cut back on the portions to try to bring them back to where they were in the early 1980s, the customers complain.
Right. And even plates, this news report had an interview with a guy who was moving into a new house or apartment, and he couldn't fit his plates into the cabinets, and he realized it was because the plates used to be smaller.
Yeah, my doctoral student, Lisa Young, Dr. Lisa Young, studied that as part of her thesis, and she looked at plate sizes, the sizes of muffin tins, the cooking equipment, and all kinds of other external indicators of the increasing size of portions. She looked at when large portions started coming into the food supply, and they started in the early 1980s, just when rates of obesity started to rise.
Hmm. And in terms of exercise, is that a key component here that you simply must exercise to keep your weight stable?
Well, it helps. And it helps in complicated ways. It's not a simple trade-off of calories. I mean, to give just an obvious example, if you have a 20-ounce soda, it contains 275 calories.
Wow.
You need to walk. The rule of thumb is it takes about a mile to walk off 100 calories. So that's a 3-mile activity right there. You can't compensate for it that way. And most of the evidence shows that patterns of physical activity have changed very little in the last 25 or 30 years, but there is no question at all that people are eating more.
Right. And what about this study that came out a while ago that alarmed me and all of my female friends who are older, that it doesn't make any difference how much you exercise, that you simply have to eat less food? I mean, I used to be able to, you know, go for a swim and live it up at night, eat a lot of food, and I can't do that anymore. I just can't do it.
When you get older, it's just much harder, and lots of us are getting older. So it's really difficult. No, you can't do it with exercise alone unless you're a marathon runner, a cross-country skier, an elite athlete, or somebody who is spending most of your day being physically active. For normal run-of-the-mill people who are, even people who live in cities where they don't have cars and are walking around, you've got to cut down on your caloric intake as you get older, or you're going to put on weight. Now, this isn't true of everybody. There are some people who are genetically programmed not to gain weight. Lucky them.
Right. Yeah, lucky them is right. Lucky them is right. The other thing that's very alarming is the number of children who are overweight and the number of children who are obese in this country. The television reports were showing of people having stomach stapling kind of surgery when they're teenagers or even younger.
I find that absolutely shocking.
Isn't it?
Completely shocking. A student in my class this semester did a report on bariatric surgery, stomach stapling, and these surgical interventions for adolescents. And I was stunned to see what the figures were, but people are doing this out of desperation.
Mm. So what is it as a society we need to do, and as individuals, do we all need to start keeping track of the calories that we're taking in? Do we need to get restaurants to rethink portion sizes and for all of us to be happier with smaller portion sizes?
Well, for an individual, you have to control the amount of food that you're eating, and the easiest way to do that is to use smaller plates, smaller cups, smaller glasses, and split the food that comes in a restaurant meal before it gets on your plate, because larger portions have more calories, and once a larger portion is in front of you, you're going to eat it. That's just how it goes. On a policy level, I think we have to do a lot to try to make it easier for people to do those kinds of things. We have to encourage restaurants to serve smaller portions. That's not going to be easy. We have to encourage packaged food makers to post the calories on the packages and to make smaller packages. That's also not going to be easy because you're fighting against the economic interests of the industry that makes its money out of selling more food, not less. I mean, in my book, Food Politics, which was subtitled How the Industry Influences Nutrition and Health, I documented how, as a natural part of doing business, food companies must sell more food in order to meet the objectives of Wall Street. That's just how our system works. And as an individual, it's very difficult to fight a system. And so you need some restrictions and constraints and checks and balances to make it easier for people to make more healthful choices.
Let's go to some phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, and our email address, talk@WPR.org. Betty in Oak Creek, hi. Hi, Betty, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, go right ahead.
The number one big thing are these kids, so many of them, the soda, not only kids, adults, the soda pop. And even though they think it's a diet soda and it's not calories, they're finding out that these sweeteners are probably worse than the sugar. And not only that, but it drains the calcium from the bones. Does anyone, have you spoken about that this morning?
Not yet, but we are now.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks. The big problem with sodas and obesity is that they have calories. And I've just seen the report of the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee, which says that on average, American children get 400 calories a day from beverages of one kind or another, and which seems like a lot of liquid calories to me. But pediatricians tell me that it is quite normal in their practices for kids who are overweight to be drinking 1,000 calories a day from sodas alone. So the first line of defense against obesity is to stop the sodas, stop the juice drinks, keep juice to an absolute minimum, and start getting kids to eat food, not drink it.
Right. Isn't that amazing? 1,000 calories a day.
Oh, 2,000 in teenagers. Not unusual.
Wow. Here's an email that's come in, and I recently have gained 15 pounds in the past 6 months. I now weigh 155. I'm 35 years old, recently joined a gym, and work out at least 3 times a week. I don't understand why the recent gain and how I can get it off. Can you suggest anything that will help?
Eating less.
Eating less, right?
Sorry.
There you go.
Sorry.
Eating less.
And it's great that you're doing the exercise because exercise is going to help with this. It's not going to do it alone, but it's going to be really good. It's going to tone muscle. It's going to keep your body fat down. There are many, many reasons for doing exercise, and don't give that up. But you're going to have to eat less. Cut out the drinks. I'd start with that.
Mm-hmm. We go to Sean in Chicago. Hi, Sean.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I'm having a good day. Thank you.
Good.
My comment to the obesity issue with the 70% is there's a lot of families out there that are struggling financially. Obviously, the economy is poor. Our unemployment rate is high, very high. So a lot of families are struggling to feed their families. So, I mean, you got to think of the fast food industry that's rocketing right now. People just don't have the means to get the healthy organic foods because they're so much more expensive. So a lot of families are starting to go to the dollar menus and things like that to feed. So I think that's a huge issue that we should look at.
It absolutely is, and thank you for raising it. I've seen statistics now where the relative price of fresh fruits and vegetables has increased by 40% since the early 1980s, whereas the relative price of fast food and junk food has declined, has gone down by about the same amount. Now, that's federal food policy that we're talking about here. We need a policy, an agricultural policy in this country that promotes health, not the profits of fast food makers. And until we get some policy changes, I'm afraid it's going to be cheaper for poor people to eat junk food.
Well, then you have the issue of not having, and this is true if you live in a city, there are very few places to buy good food in central cities, at least in this city, and I'm sure it's true of others.
It's true of very many cities, and that's why Michelle Obama's efforts to do something about childhood obesity are focusing on schools and on inner city, which food desert areas, areas of the city where there aren't any grocery stores. And a lot of communities are looking for ways in which to bring affordable, healthier foods into communities. I think it's a really good thing to do.
We go next to Susie in Viroqua. Hi, Susie.
Yes, I was calling the similar to what the other two people have spoken about, is I think we've gotten away from eating real food. My husband and I work full-time. We garden. We purchase most of our food locally or organically, and we don't spend a lot on food. For a family of four, it's right around $300 a month. So I think it is possible, and I think it's hard, and I think it takes a lot of work and a lot of dedication, but I think that the more we push these cheap, free, processed foods, the less people are going to be inclined to make their own food.
Yeah, I think we need to teach people how to cook. It's what I'm hearing from grocery store managers is that people come into the store and say, I'd really like to eat better, I'd like to eat this kind of food, but I don't know what to do with it, and they find themselves giving cooking lessons. Good idea.
I guess that is a good idea. How could we not know something so basic? What's wrong with us?
Well, it's not taught in school anymore. I learned how to cook in school in the seventh grade, or the eighth grade, and that's just not happening anymore. Parents aren't cooking. Their families are, both parents are working, and they feel like they don't have time to cook. It's much easier to just pick up a package at the supermarket or pick up some fast food and bring it home. And that's the reality of life for a great many people in our society. So we've had a lot of societal changes since the 1980s that have made it really hard for people to eat healthfully. And it's very difficult to reverse them. Once they're in place, it's very, very hard to change it. But I think eating real food, my advice always has been, when you go into a supermarket, never set foot in the center aisles. Because the real foods are on the outside aisles.
Right.
But what if people can't afford them? That's a problem. And that's a matter of federal agricultural policy that I think needs changing.
Marion Nissel, our guest the first half hour, she's in professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University, former senior nutrition policy advisor in the Department of Health and Human Services. 800-486-8655 is the number, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to your phone calls. Jackie in Drummond is next. Hi, Jackie.
Yes, I'm just kind of going a little bit different with what I thought about. I think one of the comments you made, our lifestyles have changed. You know, in the turn of the century and even up to the 60s and 70s, people had to rely more on physical activity, and that has changed, but we're still eating like we're, farmers, and I think that's a big issue. But what I really get concerned about, why aren't the doctors harsh and adamant on this? When somebody comes in with a fat baby, tell these people, your baby is fat, and you need to do something about it. I think maybe we're being too gentle.
Hmm. And there are a lot of people who are fat. I mean, we got a fat society here.
But the doctors need to be upfront about this. You know, Mrs. So-and-so, you're fat. You need to lose weight. You're going to become a diabetic. You're going to cost the medical system a lot of money. And you're not going to live very long. I mean, they need to talk like that, I think, or maybe not.
Yeah. And do you think that we just lost our guest for a minute, but we'll get her back in a moment.
What do you think about that?
I think that doctors are starting to do a little bit more of that because of the vast amount of attention that's being paid to this particular issue right now. Don't you think it's really become front and center because of the obesity rates in America?
Well, what's really interesting, I travel around in a set of people, and we've all exercised their whole life. And in the 60s, nobody told us to, and it just generated into our lifestyle. So I think unless you start very young with generating an active lifestyle, it's just really hard to change.
Yeah.
And I find myself, being kind of critical, and I can't because I think, obese people, there's a lot of prejudice against them, and I have to cut, tell myself I need to be more gentle in my mind, you know,
right,
when I see this. But there is a lot of prejudice against fat people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there is. And there are a lot of people who are overweight. Thank you very much for the call. We lost Mary, and she had to catch a bus, I know, so we probably will not get her again right now because we want her to be able to catch the bus, and maybe she had to leave a couple minutes early. So we thank Marion Nessel. We're still on the same subject, so don't go away. Those of you who are on the line here with us, we're just switching guests, and our guest now is Ken Albala. He's a professor of history at the University of the Pacific in Stockton, California, teaches courses on the Renaissance and Reformation, food history, and the history of medicine. He's the author of 9 books on food history, including Eating Right in the Renaissance, Food in Early Modern Europe, Cooking in Europe, 1250 to 1650, and The Banquet, Dining in the Great Courts of Late Renaissance Europe. He's been book reviews editor of the journal Food and Culture and Society for the past 6 years and has recently taken over as co-editor of the journal. We'll still be welcoming phone calls. 800-486-8655 is the number. Hello, Ken. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning.
Hi.
Nice to be here.
So why are 70% of us overweight?
Well, we're hit with a barrage of enticements. I think it's in the interest of industry to get us to eat more. And they're, you know, most industries are not really concerned about our waistlines. They're concerned about the profit margins. So the advertisements are very hard to resist. I mean, mm-hmm. if you walk through the aisles of a supermarket or you go into a, you know, fast food joint or something, the encouragement is to eat more.
And do you think that you've written so many books, and I don't know what people ate in 1450, I may have some sense, but not their daily diet. Have our food, have our palates changed because we're eating so many French fries and cheeseburgers and ice cream sundaes and cakes and things of that nature that we crave a different kind of food than we used to eat that was perhaps healthier for us?
Well, I'm not sure it's that. I mean, in the past, people certainly had a range of flavors that they liked, you know, spices especially, which have gone out of modern cooking for the most part, at least in savory dishes. But I think the thing that's really affected us is that a lot of our food is artificially flavored or enhanced with some sort of, with a lot of sugar and with a lot of fat that carries flavor. And I think mass-produced food is the real problem. And the fact that our palates have sort of become jaded, we're used to things having a lot of flavor and, you know, being enhanced with all sorts of artificial aromas and flavors and things like that, that it's really hard to be satisfied now. I think we eat more because there's more on our plate and it's, you know, souped up, and you know what goes into the chicken finger or chicken nugget, whatever it is so enhanced that we end up eating more of it.
So we may indeed need to relearn the basic art of cooking some things so that we know about spices. We know about how to flavor our foods.
Sure, I couldn't agree more about going back to basics and using real ingredients. In fact, I've just this week my next cookbook is coming out. And it's actually called The Lost Art of Real Cooking. So it's, you know, that's definitely, I think, what we should think about more. And it's not even necessarily, you know, the fat content or the salt or the sugar per se. I think it's the mass-produced food that is really, really artificial, and that if you end up cooking the food yourself, A, you enjoy it a lot more, but you also know what's going into it, you know, and organic is lovely, and I know, you know, not everyone can afford to eat organic vegetables and such, but I think when you prepare food, you enjoy it more, and you know exactly the ingredients that are going into it.
And when you're talking about mass-produced foods, what are the mass-produced foods that we eat in great quantities?
Well, look at snacks.
Snacks.
You know, fast food, look at anything, and even things that sometimes come with health labels. I mean, I think that's the most disturbing thing about mass-produced food now is it, you know, we'll say low-calorie, low-carb, low-gluten content, whatever it may be, to sell, and that, you know, quite often they're doing us a disservice because people think, oh, well, then I can eat much more of it. You know, this is a low-fat Oreo, or it's a chip that's not got enough as much calories or something like that. So I think it encourages us to indulge in ways that we wouldn't otherwise.
We have a full bank of phone lines. Let's just continue with them. Tom in Madison is our next caller. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, how are you?
Good. I lived in Europe a few times, and I have a sister in Italy. She actually does cooking class across the U.S.
there. Oh.
But I lived in France in 98, and to me it's kind of just a complex thing about our whole system, because I've had French friends come here, and I remember one of them, the first thing she said was, the cars are so big and everyone eats all the time. And when I was in France in 2001 visiting, I had a coffee and some little wafers. They weren't even sweet. Like 2 in the afternoon, and Matthew, he's 12 years old, I said, do you want a couple wafers? And he said, no, we just had lunch 2 hours ago. And you know, it's changed because now McDonald's is in France, and they're getting obesity with children because that's their... But I've lived in Germany, France, and Italy, and I've never seen a European... They sit down and they eat meals. And in America, we work more than anybody in the world, and everyone just... You know, I have friends, and the only friends that want to sit down and make meals, which I love to do, are my foreign friends. No one else has any time, so they just eat all day long. And also, the other guest was talking about the price of food. And in France, I lived in Paris, and it passed England or London as the most expensive city in 98, according to the Herald Tribune. And in downtown Paris, where I lived, I wasn't a tourist, so... You know, markets in every street. There's no corporate farms allowed in France. And food in Paris was cheaper than Madison in 1998.
Hmm.
It was incredible. And everyone sits down and eats breakfast. You know, for breakfast, maybe, you know, a croissant and coffee or something. But they sit down, they have lunch, they sit down, they have dinner. And I still haven't seen any fat Italian men. They're starting to get it now because McDonald's is everywhere now, so... They're starting to get obesity problems there, too.
But. Mm-hmm. Ken?
Yeah, you've brought up so many important issues. And I think the getting enjoyment out of food in the company of other people, the social, active eating together is very, very important. And I think Americans, we do work a lot, and we eat on the run, and we snack all through the day, and we eat lots of junk food in that case. And I hear people say, oh, well, I don't have time to cook, And I think it's just, well, you have time to sit in front of the TV for 3 hours, or you have time to, do other things. And I think for most people, it's just not a priority. We don't, a lot of people just don't really care what they put in their mouth. And if you watch a Frenchman or an Italian eat, I agree with you 100%. They sit down and really think about the meal. They spend an hour or more eating and enjoy it. And... and it's partly because, in general, the food is actually more expensive in Europe, and it's more expensive in almost everywhere in the world. As Americans, we spend less on food out of our household budgets than any other people on Earth. I think it's something like 6%. It's something really remarkable. And I think we don't think of food as precious. We think of it as fuel. You just sort of shovel it in, you get it over with, and then you go on to something else. And for many people to sit, and spend an hour cooking and an hour eating, and it takes up a lot of time. But, I mean, what could be more important, really?
Thank you, Tom, so much for the call. Mary in Wisconsin Dells, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Mary.
I think this probably has more to do with the previous lady, but do you think the reason, I have two things, do you think the reason that the numbers are so high now is because most of the United States population are baby boomers, and let's face it, we do gain weight as we get older?
Yeah, that could be also, I think it's a generational thing also. Americans... And I saw this in my father's generation. Someone who grew up in the Depression was born to immigrant parents, and the United States was a place of plenty, and it was not... it wasn't that being fat, there was no stigma against it. There certainly was, but eating well and eating a lot of meat and putting a lot of food on your plate was a sign of affluence. It was having arrived and being in the United States, and I think especially after World War II, when foods, when subsidizing of ingredients became the norm, food became very cheap, and to put a lot of food on the table just became ordinary, and I think that, the portion size has just been getting bigger and bigger in the past several decades, mostly because the food is so cheap. And I mean, even in restaurants, if you think about it, what they're really paying for, what the restaurant's budget really entails, is paying salaries, paying rent. The food is cheap. They can afford to make bigger plates and put more food on it. And in many people's minds, Americans, I think uniquely in the world, is that we think if there's not a lot there, it's not value. we're not getting
right.
our money's worth. And we'd rather have far too much to eat on the plate and take it home in a doggy bag or throw it away rather than and have a sensible portion that will, you know, be satisfying.
But clearly most of us are not throwing it away. We're eating it, and so we're getting fatter. So the issue of portions has to be addressed, how big our portions are, right?
I don't see how it could happen. I mean, in a country that loves buffets. I mean, I think that's like the earmark of perversity in my mind.
It's
a place you can go and eat as much as you want. In fact, I was traveling with someone from Europe last week, and we passed many, hometown buffets and Golden Corral and places like that. And she was just perplexed at the idea that you would sit down and just have endless amount of food.
I know.
That's value in many people's minds. And I think it does come from, this insecurity about, if you come from a family who once, or even parents who did not always have enough to eat, it's sort of in your mind that volume is good.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mary. Mark in Madison. Hi.
Hi, I just had a comment. I don't really know if it's a question about the corn industry. I've heard that the numbers are as high as 50% of our calories in America are from cornstarch, and I don't know whether that's validated or not as fact, but what I do know is that if you subsidize alcohol, you're going to have a lot of alcoholics. I mean, it's pretty common knowledge. Why are we putting this stuff into our children and then scratching our heads, wondering why one in three of the next generation is going to have early onset diabetes? And I'll take my answer off
there.
Okay,
thanks, Mark.
You're absolutely right. I mean, corn is subsidized by the government, and it encourages manufacturers to use corn in every single way they can. And it's not just corn starch, it's corn oil, it's high fructose corn syrup, it's everything derived from corn. In fact, if you've seen this, a really interesting documentary called King Corn.
Yes, very good.
In which people have their DNA tested, or their molecules tested, and it turns out that they're mostly made of corn. And it's processed food for the most part. It's not going to be the corn on the cob that you eat, at a barbecue. That's minuscule compared to the processed corn products. And things that you would never expect, the chemicals that ultimately go into processed food, usually come from either corn or soy. Soy is another thing that's subsidized.
Here's an email from Carson in Lake Geneva. Can you comment on banning toys from McDonald's Happy Meals? I heard a story on NPR this morning. Clearly, healthy and unhealthy eating habits begin in childhood. In my view, McDonald's and all fast food restaurants are the bane of our society and slowly killing us. Just
here,
my
here.
Opinion.
you agree. 100%. And I can speak from personal experience that when my kids were younger, just a couple years ago, they were really interested in the toy. They weren't so crazy about the food. It was as long as you could get some little doodad. And it's really, it's partly the fast food industry. It's also the collusion with the movie industry. They're the ones who promote their movies through the through the little figures that they give away at McDonald's and Burger King and those things. So I think that would be a great law, actually. Food places should only be allowed to sell food. And I heard it once, I'm not sure if this is true, that the largest distributor of toys in the country is McDonald's.
Really?
Yeah, and it's through the little figurines and things they give away with Happy Meals.
Wow. And then eventually you have to throw them out. What do you do with all that stuff?
Yeah, you throw it away.
You throw it out. Yeah, that's a problem. Nancy in Madison, hi.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to tell you something that I had read a few years ago that made quite an impression on me, and it had to do with a single mother who said that she put dinner on the table every night, and it was a way of getting the kids to come home and gather together. And she felt that made a big impression on the fact that her family was able to stay together intact. But what I did a couple of years ago when my two grandchildren were in middle school is I had time on my hands as well. And I brought them here once a week, if they could make it, and taught them some simple cooking skills. We started out with things that they liked, like tacos. And we advanced as far as making bread at one point.
Oh.
But so they were the ones who were coming home from school with not much to do except then I thought, well, they could be the ones who could arrange meals and get something started for dinner because both their parents were working. And they did do that. And the way we began was we started out making a menu, And I dropped them off at the grocery store with $20 and let them go in and do all the shopping. And then we came back here, and then we assembled a meal. And we put it together nicely on the table with candles and took photos. And we did that off and on for about a year. And I think they have carried on with that quite nicely. But so my main point is, let's look at who's got the time to do some cooking, some simple cooking, preparing a meal. And if it's the grandparents who can help the kids at that age get started on something, I think that would be a very positive thing to do. And coming together at the end of the day around a meal is a very important thing for families. And one other thing I wanted to mention, too, is the price of spices. And to do real cooking, you need spices. And I'd like to encourage people to make herb gardens, for instance, which you can just do in pots sitting in your windowsill.
I love your thoughts. That's great. Somebody ought to do a book on that. Like maybe you, Nancy. That's a great idea, isn't it?
Yeah,
because
it's fabulous. And I couldn't agree with you more that cooking with children is probably the most important life lesson you can give them. The pleasures of eating with their family and having to talk. It's actually the only rule I have in my house is that everyone has to eat together in the evening at a dining table with silverware and everything. It's definitely important. And, I don't know where the disjunct happened historically, like when people stopped being at the apron strings of their mothers or being in the kitchen and being around cooking just to sort of absorb it indirectly or directly. But I'm amazed that when I, with my undergraduates, and these are 18 to 22-year-olds or so, is that they have never shopped, they've never cooked, they don't know basic ingredients. And for one of my food policy courses, I take them into the supermarket and I say, okay, you have $100, you have a family of five, write down the ingredients that you would buy to make a meal and how to do it. And they just could not figure it out. It was almost impossible. One guy ended up buying frozen corn dogs. It was just unbelievable how little they knew. No one had ever sat down with them and said, here's how you actually put together a meal. Here's how you cook. Anyway, it's
frozen
it's a
corn
shame,
dogs. Oh my gosh. I hope you weren't invited to that dinner table. That would have been terrible. And it's such a basic thing that we all do, or maybe it's a sign that we just aren't all doing this anymore. It seems to me as though it's something you have to learn in order to live.
That's right. Well, I think it's in the interest of most food manufacturers not to have us cook. They would prefer that we buy something microwavable or instant or take out, because that the cost of prepared food is much more. They make much more profit margin on that.
Ken Albala is our guest. He has a book coming out next week, I guess, The Lost Art of Real Cooking. He's a professor of history at the University of the Pacific in Stockton, California. Teaches a variety of courses on the Renaissance and Reformation, food history, the history of medicine, and is the author of 9 books on food history. Our number is 800-486-8655. Nancy, thanks for your great call. We'll take more calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, the author of an important book, Broke USA, From Pawn Shops to Poverty, How the Working Poor Became Big Business. James Fallows writes about this book. James, of course, from The Atlantic. The abuse of the working poor, as Rivlin, the author of this book, describes it, is a hugely growing industry. This is a book with the potential to stimulate outrage and political reform. So that's tomorrow during this hour. We also want to remind you, you can connect with us on Facebook. Just search for the Kathleen Dunn Show, become a fan. We're close to hitting the 1,000 fan mark, and we're going to celebrate when we do that. We'll randomly select some of you and give you a copy. This is fun. You get a free present. Some of you will be receiving a copy of a book that we have covered recently. So go to Facebook, find the show, become a fan. You can also meet other listeners and post comments and maybe get some free reading material. Ken is with us until the top of the hour, and we're going back to phone calls to Dave from Evansville, Indiana next. Hi, Dave.
Hi. It's great to be on with you, Kathleen and Dr. Albala. My comment
is on the state of the built environment. I'm an urban planner, and I have been involved with planning for community health for a while, and there have been so many studies now that have recognized the how obesity has just skyrocketed, and one of the key factors in, is that we have made it hard for people to walk, to bike, to do things that used to be convenient for people 40 or 50 or 60 more years ago. Just can't go out in your neighborhood and walk anymore because your neighborhood might not have sidewalks. So that's one of the things that we need to try to remedy through our public policies generally. You know, developers are partly responsible for that, but if we don't have public policies in place that will enforce those communities to develop sidewalks when the subdivision's built or provide bikeways, we're not going to have those facilities because developers in general will cite that they're too expensive or they make their costs of their products too high for their competition to compete.
Sure, that's very, very important. And I think as a car culture in general, the suburbanization of the United States in general means that even people who live near cities end up going to supermarkets, and supermarkets encourage us to overeat. I mean, they are, you know, people are in this mindset that they have to fill up their whole shopping cart, buy everything for the week, put it in their refrigerator, and be stocked, you know, up to the gills, which means you end up always buying a lot more than you need, which is, you know, the whole idea. But it's, you know, going back to what someone was saying before, in Europe, most people still walk to the supermarket. They have tiny little fridges, and people wonder, like, how do they keep all their food? Well, they shop every day, you know. They stop on the way back from the train or wherever they've been at work and go to a greengrocer and go to the fish market or to the butcher. And the you know, you're right that zoning, I think, is really a major factor in this that most food policymakers don't think about at all. Is that we're encouraged to get in our cars and go places, you know, and not walk to the supermarket or walk to a restaurant. I'm absolutely right.
Hmm. Thank you so much, Dave, for your call.
Thank you.
Ron in Iowa. Hi, Ron.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I'm a manager of a casual fast food restaurant, and what I see is a lot of people coming in, I think... schools are not teaching enough for our young people of physical education, and that's one of the reasons I'm thinking about a career change. Because instead of taking maybe a salad that doesn't cost any extra, and that goes back to what one of the callers said about how expensive food is, a lot of people will upgrade to an onion ring or something like that for extra money. So it's not really the cost. It's just that we're not teaching people how to be good stewards of their body or their money. So that was my comment.
Thank you, Ron. Ken?
Thanks. Well, yeah, onion rings are more interesting than salads. I hate
right.
to say it. They look enticing, you know. I don't really, honestly, I can't tell you why people make the choices they do. And I think if, you know, we have nutritional experts, we have people tell them, you know, you need to eat more fresh fruits and vegetables and this and that. But when it comes down to it, people really don't care. They would want something that tastes good. And you know, I guess when you have a jaded palate and you've been eating chips and other things all day, a salad just doesn't taste that interesting, unless you cover it with ranch dressing, in which case it's probably not very good for you anyway. But I mean, the only solution, this has been, people have suggested this, and I think having a tax on fast food or junk food or whatever you want to call it, it's been tried here and there. And interestingly, people pay it. It's sort of like a tax on tobacco, you know, and alcohol. People want the stuff, they're going to pay it. And it doesn't, as economists would suggest, you know, discourage people from eating that sort of thing. Let me give you a bizarre and extreme example. Someone was talking about the most expensive place in the world. And Paris is close. Oslo, Norway, is for reasons that I have no idea why.
absurdly expensive. And in fact, the state mandates that it, to buy a glass of beer costs $12.
Goodness.
To buy a pack of cigarettes, and I cost, I think it was $34. It was something absolutely ridiculously obscene. And their logic was that, well, if it costs so much money, people aren't going to do it so much. And they probably do less, you know. They still, they, you know, people who smoke still smoke there, but it has to be really, really exorbitant in order to have a negative, you know, to discourage people from buying it.
I guess. Let's go to Tina next from Oshkosh. Hi, Tina.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, if soybeans are so easy to grow and they're even subsidized, you know, if we grow it in the form of edamame, shouldn't it be at the center of our table two or three times a day or a week?
Yeah, well, the soybeans that they grow for industry are a slightly different variety. The edamame are green, underripe soybeans that are harvested fresh, and they're really not that cheap. I mean, they're a, you know, a fresh vegetable that you've got to move quickly or it goes bad. The soybeans that are used, processed in industry are mature and they're dried, and then they're processed to make oil and to make vegetable proteins and even things like tofu. But they're not exactly the same product. I think what most people grow through the Midwest that's subsidized is the industrial soy, and it's mostly genetically modified too. You know, I mean, that's a whole other argument discussion we could bring into it. But
we did have an email from the director of the WIC program in Wisconsin, and they want to remind people that they offer participants cash checks to purchase fresh, frozen, and canned fruits and vegetables. Children under 5 get so much money. Women get money. Infant gets baby food. They also provide whole grain foods, bread, rice, tortillas. And in the summer, they provide money for families to use at farmers markets. This is nice.
That's
or
great.
Farm stands. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
So for more information about the program, 800-722-2295. 800-722-2295. We thank the director.
Are people in the farmers markets, the farmers in Wisconsin, able to take food stamps? I mean, are they equipped to do that? Because I know that's a problem in many places where the state is trying to encourage people to buy fresh vegetables rather than cans, which, you know, are easier to do for donations. But a lot of farmers aren't equipped to deal with WIC programs.
Yeah. I don't know the answer to that. I'm about to go to a farmer's market. I'm just noticing them behind me setting up in downtown Milwaukee. But I don't know, so I can't say on the air until after I go there.
Okay.
But we'll post it on our Facebook, or maybe somebody will call in, too. We go next to Dia in Burlington. Hi, Dia.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm on a cell, so I hope it'll be okay.
Okay.
I am a farmer's market vendor. I'm in Burlington, which is a small farmer's market, and we just got a grant to have to accept the cards that
right.
the WIC and
oh, good.
Food stamps receive.
Good.
That's fantastic.
But I'm a grass-fed beef farmer, and my point was that I am not organic, and I keep hearing the word organic bandied about. And I know a lot of the vegetable producers at the farmers markets also are not organic. And I've worked with low-income people in the past. And I think when we keep using that term, and then they go to the market and they see the price of organic, they say, that excludes me. And I think we can eat healthy, even though we can't purchase organic. So I kind of wish we'd make a dissemination between, you know, fresh, especially local, produce. You know, just like when they talk about shopping the outside aisles of the supermarket, that's where the healthier, unprocessed foods are.
Yeah, I think you've hit on a dilemma that really is very important. People have conflicting values. They want to eat fresh, but sometimes out of season, you can't get something that's local. They want to eat things that aren't grown with pesticides, maybe in interest of the environment or their own health or whatever it may be. But the cost, you know, is sometimes prohibitive. And if you want to buy, you know, lovely heirloom baby arugula, it's going to be expensive. And it's a shame in some respects that organic food has become the preserve of people who are affluent, you know.
And if I could add, like the small farmers that I know, pesticides cost them money. So if they don't have to use them, they're not going to.
That's right. Yeah, and it's harder, you know, it's harder to grow food or using organic methods. I think when people, I think when the market for organic becomes bigger, the price will come down. And, you know, I often don't buy it just because it's more expensive. We have a little organic section in my supermarket, and it's sometimes, you know, 30, 40 cents per pound more for apples or something like that. And they're not always good. You know, just because something is organic doesn't mean it tastes great. It can be organic and shipped from halfway around the world, or it can be, you know, the salad in the bag that's filled with gas to make it inert and grown and shipped halfway around the country. So you know, your food miles are exorbitant.
Right.
So I think, you know, these words, especially organic, is used as a marketing tool right now. And
We're out of time. Your book is coming out next week, The Lost Art of Real Cooking?
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. It's things that are difficult and dangerous and things you should try at home. Sourdough bread, curing meat, making pickles, stuff that actually you people in the Midwest probably do a lot more than most people in the country. But
Ken. Thank you. Ken Albala, our guest, professor of history at the University of the Pacific in Stockton, California. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. And thanks for listening and all your engagement with the program, everybody. We'll be with you tomorrow at 9 o'clock.